Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. This is where I try to find out things I really know nothing about. It's outside my comfort zone and yours too, I hope. Remember that Podcast from the Edge is available in the Financial Mail online and on the Apple and Spotify podcast platforms. As we get further into our energy conversation in South Africa, what with Eskom being unreliable and coal heading for euthanasia, there's much excitement about renewable energy, wind power and solar. There's lots of wind and lots of sunshine here in SA, so you'd think that would be it, but no. First, wind and solar are great, it seems, while the sun's shining and the wind's blowing, but there's no storage, people say. Second, there's the great and fairly new gas debate. Because coal creates so many jobs, probably no more than around 100,000 direct jobs, the politics require that we look after the jobs while we move from coal to renewables. In the long interim, Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe and a big chunk of business are pushing for gas. And that would mean that between now and 2050, by the time we are supposed to be carbon net zero, we have to build a national gas infrastructure network and then, presumably, a solar and wind one too after that. It sounds complicated and expensive. Fortunately, I have as a guest today Jesse Burton, an energy policy advisor, senior researcher at the University of Cape Town. And Jesse, thank you so much for your time. But does it really make sense to build a whole new transitional infrastructure for gas starting sort of now, or starting to think about it now? This could take more than a decade.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for having me today. I think that's a really good way to ask the question. And I think there's a simple answer and there's a complicated answer. And I think we'll have a long discussion about the complicated elements of it. The simple answer is no, it doesn't really make sense to do that. We want to absolutely minimize these investments that could become what are called stranded assets. A stranded asset just means it's an asset that you don't utilize fully, and so you don't make your money back on it. And we want to minimize the risks of stranded assets. We want to minimize the risk of wasting very scarce capital in investing in the wrong thing. And that's the easy part of the answer. The complicated part of that answer is, when we look at the technical, economic, political, and social factors, what exactly is that level of small infrastructure investment, and what are the implications for the South African economy?
And so, assuming that it was interesting. So we have as a base plan, as you well know, something called the IRP, right? It's the Integrated Resource Plan, 2019. It sort of set out a path from here to 2050, how much coal power we'd have to decommission, how much wind and solar we would buy. But it was interesting with gas, because they write in that we would be looking to install around about 3,000 megawatts of new gas power during this long period. And that mainly it would be to convert these closed or open cycle gas turbines that we so depend, diesel turbines, I mean, that we so depend on now to top up Eskom when it's failing, and that those would be converted to gas, and that's where the gas would be used. I don't know if I've got that right, but what appears to be happening now is a push partly from the government via Gwede Mantashe, but also in a big new report from the National Business Initiative, to which a lot of very powerful CEOs have put their names, there's a push now for a much bigger role for gas in the transition between now and 2050. What has happened?
So I think a good place to start is to understand how models like the model used in the IRP actually work. We're very lucky in South Africa. We've actually got several groups who do that kind of modeling. And so, unlike in some other countries, we can kind of test and assess each other's work as time goes on. What the IRP aims to do is to balance supply and demand at every moment of the day over many years into the future. So these are very complicated. It was much more complicated when you had to build things like nuclear or coal plants, because it took 10 or 15 years to bring that infrastructure online. So really you were kind of guessing in the dark. And we can see that the impacts of those kinds of inflexible infrastructure decisions. You think demand will be X, it's actually much lower than X, but you've built these large, chunky plants that come online many years after you expect them to. And of course, you accumulate a whole lot of debt as that happens. What has happened is that what we now call variable renewable energy, wind and solar, has become much cheaper. You alluded to this earlier. And the IRP acknowledges this. Most of what gets built over the next decade is in the form of solar PV and wind. This is for many reasons, not least because they're the cheapest, but also because, of course, we have a huge air pollution challenge in South Africa, and we're one of the most carbon-intensive economies in the world. What is the role of gas in this electricity system? Is that typically what you want to be able to do is, in some weeks, for example, where you have very bad sun and very low wind, you want to be able to turn something on. And in the past, what you did is you could turn on your coal plants, for example. But coal plants are very inflexible. They don't like to be turned up and down a lot. It's very costly. It's very bad for them. So increasingly what is happening is that you want to kind of complement that variable wind and solar with flexible capacity. Now, what we see happening in all of the modeling groups in the country who are looking at this is that the cheapest form of that flexible capacity, first of all, you want to build a lot of batteries. So all of the models agree. We build a lot of batteries, and that's for kind of every day. If the wind drops, the battery comes up in the peak, you know, when demand is very high in the evenings. But what happens is that batteries only run for a certain amount of time. So you have to complement that with something that you can store. In the long run, you know, what that will probably be is what is called green hydrogen, which is hydrogen made from renewable energy. But in the interim, there's a lot of debate around how much gas do we need to fill that role. So if we have 5 days of no wind and sun, what happens? Now, because gas turbines are very cheap to build, but very expensive to run, what these kinds of models like to do and power systems want to do is build a lot of them and run them very little. And this is where there starts to be disagreement between all of the experts. How much do they need to run? Because that impacts a lot. What is that supporting infrastructure that you need to build? Do we need to build new import terminals, for example, or can we use the existing pipeline that we have into Mozambique that supplies gas to us?
Just, it was interesting that the NBI report settles on a solution. It goes through a lot of possibilities, as you're talking about the pipeline from Mozambique, or do we build terminals? And it seems to settle, Jesse, on a solution which basically consists of building, I presume, terminals in Kucha, Richards Bay, and Saldanha, and possibly what in Motala, which I think is in Mozambique, and that these would be fed by basically what they call floating storage regasification units, which is a ship, basically. It's got a big bulbous tanks on it, and they would ship liquid natural gas, presumably from Mozambique, to these places, and they would be then fed into an infrastructure of some kind. And I guess the question that I can't find an answer to in here is what that infrastructure looks like. Is it from port to the existing or the converted peaking power plant, or is it wider than that? What is your understanding? How big is the NBR solution?
So what the NBR have done, which is really great, is they've looked at four different scenarios. They've said, what if we have more supply of gas? What if we don't have more supply of gas? And what if our demand is very high? And what if our demand is very low? And then they look at all those nodes, as you say. Do we have Kucha and Saldanha and Richards Bay and Matola? Matola's, in Mozambique. And how do we kind of balance the costs of the big users? So power is a big user in the modeling, as is Sasol Synfuels, the conversion of the synfuels from coal to liquids to gas to liquids. And then there's some industry and there's some transport. The big ones are power and synfuels though. Now what happens in the report is, and I just want to flag that this competing analysis is quite closely aligned with their low demand scenario. And their low demand scenario basically shows that there's very limited increase in demand for gas this decade. By around 2030, it's just over the pipeline capacity from Mozambique, what we call the ROMCO pipeline, and So based on that, based on the fact that this is kind of where I see a lot of agreement between different groups, of course, it's very dependent on what your assumptions are about the power sector and GDP growth and all of that. But there is some agreement that that's kind of the world we're looking at. Now, the solution that the NBI comes up with is that for negotiating reasons, we should have multiple landing points, those FSRUs in different places, because it would give South Africa strategic advantage in the price negotiations. I disagree with that. I think it's such a small amount of gas that it would, you know, we're not going to have a huge amount of cost associated. Right. With only having one of those little bits of infrastructure built.
Okay.
And it's very cheap to build some of those midstream assets. So they assess this. They look at, you know, building the link from Matola to the existing pipeline, for example, using the gas we can from Mozambique that already exists. And then they look at the three different places. But what they've analyzed is lumping them together. There isn't one that says, okay, let's just look at Matola and Richards Bay, for example. The other part of this is, of course, the politics and the commercial realities. All of the modeling is saying, look, we need to maybe build these OCGTs because they're flexible, dispatchable capacity, and they can be used to supplement the rest of the power system if needed. But the reality is that what is being developed in the market is very many gigawatts. Gigawatt is just a measure of how big a power plant is. 25 gigawatts of plants are being developed, and a lot of them are being planned to use far more gas. So not being used at very low levels, below 10% per annum, you know, much higher, 50, 60, what is called base load gas. And that's very expensive.
Do you see 25 gigawatts in this country?
Yes, that's what those are the projects that are actually looking for environmental authorization at the moment.
Are these private companies trying to build this power?
Yeah, some are private. As well as developing 3 gigawatts at Richards Bay, and a kind of a variety of private companies.
And is this in response to the liberalisation of embedded power, are these older plans?
I think it's in large part it's a response to the 3 gigawatts that's in the IRP. So it's plants that are planning to bid in, I assume, but of course the terms of that look like matters a lot, because if you're developing what's called a CCGT and you're planning to run it at 60 or 70%, that's a very different proposition to building a flexible OCGT that's going to run at below 10%. And the money is made on gas. The money is not made on building this infrastructure. So there's an incentive to try and kind of inflate that in the real world. So the modelers all agree with each other that what we need is some of this capacity to be built and for it to be run very little. But in the real world, that's not what is being planned. That's kind of where a lot of the stranded asset risk comes in.
And so let me just ask you then, so because it sounds so, it sounds like so, such a big risk. We land gas in Richards Bay, Kucha, and Saldanha, and these things feed existing open cycle gas turbines in Saldanha, Ankerlich, Dedisa, I think at Kucha. Do we need new gas turbines, or do we just simply rebuild the ones that we have to use gas instead of diesel?
So it's much cheaper to use gas in those existing OCGTs. One has already been converted, I believe, from the NBI report, because it's cheaper and there's lower carbon emissions associated with burning the gas rather than diesel. Mm. I think if that can happen in a very light touch way, that's not a huge amount of risk. But what is being proposed is, you know, repurposing Eskom coal plants as gas plants, you know, inland demand system.
And who's proposing that?
I've the minister said he's expecting an application from Eskom any day now. But this is also what is modeled in some of the NBI scenarios. So the reason for their different demand scenarios depends very much also on what they've assumed about that process.
Yes.
And so that to me wouldn't necessarily make sense, or it could make sense, but we need a lot more analysis first.
In the NBR report, they say in both scenarios, low demand that you were talking about just now and high demand, new gas infrastructure is going to be necessary. That it would need a decision would need to be made soon, like by next year. But the infrastructure itself would be required by 2030, 2035. And as you say, that's a big jump, even if it's, you know, even if it's relatively modest infrastructure, it's still a lot to spend on something that we may not end up using. You've talked about batteries. Where are we now with batteries, and where will we be in 2030? In terms of technology, I mean, how much more capable will batteries be?
So there's lots and lots. In fact, I don't even track all the different kinds of battery names because they are so complicated, that are under development. This is a hugely active space of research. Of course, everyone hears about the energy transition all the time, but you know, there's all the way from kind of blue skies to commercial development is happening. We're kind of lagging a little bit. You know, there's a proposal for, I can't remember the size, I think 500 megawatts of batteries. It's in the IRP.
That's right, yeah.
And I think we should be moving on that. We need more of this peaking capacity in the system anyway. In the same way that we should be moving a little bit faster, I think, or at least trying to keep up with the IRP on the wind and solar. Because a lot of what we're happening in the system right now with the load shedding is because we're not able to top up the pump storage, for example. We're running out of that
energy. And we're not able to because we're not able to legally or technically.
No, technically, because we don't have enough generation. So, you know, you'll see sometimes Eskom will go up a stage because the pump storage they can't move the top dam. So any energy we can get onto the system very quickly, I think, will be very valuable in the short term. Over the next decade, of course, what we see is if we stick to the IRP, there's this huge build out of wind and solar. There's some capacity in the IRP, like new coal, which I think is very unlikely to be built. But the advantage is that from when the IRP was done to now, we've seen demand and GDP growth is much, much lower. So there's not so much risk if we don't build some of that capacity. So this is a huge question. And of course, there's all sorts of other opportunities that are also quite nascent in terms of long duration storage, thermal storage. You know, you can, but like the CSP plants, that's being trialed in some coal plants in other parts of the world. You use the molten salts as the storage, and you actually can reuse some of your coal plant infrastructure. You can, you know, there's kind of different opportunities. And so for me, kind of minimizing that risk, I think, is really important. And the NBR report does do this. You know, they assess what is the cost of the capital we might not be able to pay back, et cetera, et cetera. But what they don't explore is a scenario where they don't have multiple FSRUs, for example. So they don't just say, well, let's just use Matola and a little bit of Richards Bay, for example, or just Matola and a little bit of Soldana. They always have the multiple nodes being developed, which they explain is for strategic reasons. And I think that might be, you know, we probably could go a step further and really delve down into a minimal build plan.
So when you speak to, you know, sort of grown-ups in the area, like the minister and CEOs and all of that, they would regard what I'm thinking and possibly what you think as being dangerous and reckless, that you can't take risks with the economy, that you need to be prepared for all eventualities, and that it's perfectly reasonable to, use the coal that we've got, back it up with gas. And yes, wouldn't it be lovely, you know, eventually to have a lot of solar and wind and batteries, but that's for the future and not for now. I find it very difficult to argue back because I'm not expert enough and I don't know enough. But when I'm spoken to, it's almost patronizing, but they sound as if they have a point. They're the people taking the risk. It's their money.
Of course. And we've had 15 years of load shedding and load shedding in the 80s and load shedding in the 50s. And so this fear, I think, is very strong in the hearts of the political leadership, especially in the energy sector. But for all that worry, they haven't actually brought any new capacity online. My response to that is two. The fastest things to get on the system are wind and solar. They're very cheap now. I mean, they're a bit more expensive because modules are taking up, but that. The second part of it is that open cycle gas turbines are also relatively quick to build. You know, this isn't a nuclear plant. This isn't a 15 or 18 year runway. So I think we can afford to kind of just, you know, step back a little bit, take a considered approach to the whole thing and use the existing pipeline because we're not using it at its full capacity at the moment. The Romco pipeline, it's got a capacity of, I don't know, 210 petajoules. That's also just an energy measurement.
That's a lot.
We're only using 180. So there's a little bit of increase there. The problem is that those fields are starting to decline, and this is where Matola comes in. So can you bring gas in, do the LNG at Matola where they're already developing infrastructure and use it? The other part of this, of course, we could buy power from Mozambique.
Well, absolutely. But is it reliable? This is, you know, there are separatists in insurgencies in northern Mozambique. Sounds like a very dangerous place to rely on for your, you know, for your economic future.
Of course. I mean, the one advantage of LNG, of course, is that it doesn't have to come from a particular place. So once you have an FSRU, that gas can really come from anywhere. Yeah. You know, the LNG terminal in Matola, you can buy it from somewhere else if you need to. So it does give you a little bit of that flexibility.
Are gas prices very sensitive to political events? Ukraine at the moment is obviously, or Russia particularly, is a big gas supplier. What happens to gas prices?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is partly the reason I would also take my foot off the accelerator a little bit. It would be to see what happens in the coming years. Russia is a huge oil, especially and coal, and a lesser gas and a big supplier into Europe. So as Europe maybe swivels to try and purchase from elsewhere, that could have all sorts of other ramifications. But gas prices are also very variable. So a few years ago, they were at kind of historic lows, and then they were at historic highs, and That does create some risk, although I would assume that a sensible commercial approach would be to lock in long-term contracts. For the country, the important thing there is to lock in very flexible contracts. So even if you take a little bit of a hit on a high price, it's to not have locked yourself into buying the gas for a baseload gas plant, because that's not what we're going to need. That's much more expensive. What you want is little bits of gas filling in rather than a big gas plant running all the time, because that will have huge implications for the power sector costs, for example.
Yes. Jesse, just explain something to me. So you made the point just now about pumping water. So Eskom having to go up a stage because it needs to pump water, because it needs that hydropower. Is it used as peak power, or is it used as storage? What was the original thinking behind having this facility? There's one big one in KwaZulu, one in Cape Town. What was the original thought? What was it there for?
So pump storage is exactly this. I mean, it gives you the opportunity to.
It's storage
because electricity, until we had batteries, you couldn't store electricity. You have to always keep the system in balance. I remember one of the stories my lecturers always used to tell was the moment, you know, when there's an ad break in the World Cup and everyone ends up and puts their kettle on and you suddenly get a big surge in demand. But you've got to do that at every minute of every day. And pump storage is one way of doing that. It's very cheap. It's one of the cheaper ways of doing that historically. That's why. And you can also, when you have too much supply almost, you know, if demand is low, but you had inflexible plants like coal plants, you can't turn them up and down all the time. You can use that electricity to pump the water up to a top dam and then release it when you need it. So all of these technologies are there to smooth the peaks and troughs of supply and demand and keep them in balance. What's different about renewable is that they are dispatched by the weather rather than by gas. Yes. So it's slightly more complicated.
Right. But so if Eskom needs to shut us down in order to just pump, you seem to be suggesting that the current solar and wind capacity that we have could be better used to do that anyway. My understanding is that they have an agreement with Eskom for the amount of power that they sell into Eskom. And one presumes that's not a 24-hour cycle. But one also presumes that, particularly for wind, that the wind blows at night and during the day, and that there would be power literally all the time. I mean, depending on where you are. And I just wonder whether we use the power that we have or the capacity that we have to good effect. If hydro is storage and Eskom is failing, and you're suggesting that we should do more solar, more wind, what's stopping more solar and more wind is just the politics, right? The government is saying, no, you can't. Or is it Eskom saying, no, you can't. We can't take all of that.
Well, there's of course a political element to this, which has played out over many of the last 5 or 6 years, of course, which has kind of slowed everything down. The other big challenge for Eskom is that they have not been investing, or they've not had the capital to invest in the transmission and distribution infrastructure that they need to. Medupi and Kusile and Angula have sucked a lot of that capital into them. And so our best renewable resources, which are in the Northern Cape, there's now very little what is called evacuation capacity. The transmission grid, the wires, there's no space left on them. So they've got a big, almost decade-long challenge to build that out sufficiently. And in the interim, what we have, which is very valuable, is Eskom retiring coal plants in Mpumalanga, close to load, with transmission infrastructure. So using that, I think, does two things. It lets you use that infrastructure. It lets you avoid the fact, get around the fact that we've starved transmission of capital. And it also provides some kind of just transition support. So you can retrain workers and you can kind of build new value chains in that space.
When Komati closes in Mpumalanga in October, apparently, that means that potentially a wind or solar or renewables power could get onto the grid without overloading it or being too much. The grid could take it. So is the just transition as it occurs in the political mind, i.e. slow movement from coal to gas to renewables, is it a false economy? I mean, is it, the idea is to save the jobs. I understand that, and you feel nobody wants to put somebody out of a job. But surely the quicker we do this, the quicker we get safe and get back to growth. Surely by dragging it out, we are opening ourselves up to errors and mistakes and cost in the over the next decade or two.
Absolutely. So that socioeconomic assessment is very important. And I mean, I find this very interesting in the gas debate because it doesn't often actually come up, is that there are very few jobs at a gas plant. There's roughly as many per gigawatt installed in wind and solar and coal, a little bit more in renewables than in coal, not that many in gas. We'd have to check the exact number. But the part of, the risk of big gas and big infrastructures that you make power prices very expensive. And that has all these knock-on effects into energy intensive industry and all along the value chain. Of course, the just transition, it's become fashionable to say orderly. It must be orderly. And of course it must be orderly. You can't just have chaos unfolding. But in some ways, by not being honest about the fact that it's coming, what has happened is that people have not prepared. We should have been preparing for a transition away from coal from 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, in fact, because then you have time to build out alternative sectors. And in Mpumalanga, you have time to build an industrial development strategy for the region, for example. You have time to plan, what are we going to do in these sites? And Eskom is now doing a lot of this, They're thinking about repowering and repurposing and all of that. But yeah, I think there'd be a lot of advantage in really, kind of going big, really starting to build out a huge new sector with the accompanying
renewables
with the accompanying manufacturing. And it would limit the cost increases in the power sector, of course, because every time you build something that's more expensive, you make power more expensive for all the users in the economy. And that's a big, it's been a huge drag. I see something like 35 billion rand, excluding 2021 and 2022. And last year was as much load shedding as the previous four. So we're looking at, probably 100 billion rands worth of economic loss.
Yeah, well, that's something to think about. Jesse Burton, thank you very, very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I do know how pressed you are. And I hope you listeners too enjoyed Jesse Burton as much as I did. I'm going to try and find more people to talk about energy and climate change in these podcasts. Ukraine aside, climate change is a story of our lifetimes and we have to understand it better. Thank you for joining, and I'll be back again next week. Be safe. Bye-bye.